All right, everyone, it's 7 o'clock. I want to honor everyone's time. So with us today is my friend Cynthia. I met Cynthia this summer while we were in Germany. We went to a burn and we just were there just chit chat and talking about stuff. And I don't know how it came up, but Cynthia's story came up and I said, oh, we are not supposed to just be friends that met at a burn. We're also supposed to be colleagues. So let's talk later. And this is the first time we've had a chance to do that. So
Yes.
Cynthia, tell us your story.
Okay, so my story actually begins almost 7 years ago. So this was in the fall of 2018. And during that time period, I have started a project with someone, but he ended up ripping me off for quite a bit of money.
Ooh.
So after everything that I had been through in my life, I was almost 43 years old back then, so I hit a very low point where I pretty much gave up on life. I mean, I was dealing with all kinds of things my whole entire life, and I just was done. And actually, back then, this is the first time I'm being open about it. And I think by being open, but with this, it will encourage others to talk more openly about what is really going on with them. So at that time, I had read an article on San Pedro Cactus. I became curious, not because I was seeking healing. You have to understand, I thought I was okay, considering all the traumas that I had in my life. I thought I was doing perfectly fine, but my behavior and the situations that I found myself in told otherwise. But I didn't recognize this at that time, so I decided to try San Pedro Cactus, which is a mescaline. And it was only to give me ideas because I remember reading about Steve Jobs doing psychedelics to inspire him for ideas. So I thought, well, if it worked for Steve Jobs, maybe it can work for me, right? And that was the whole reason I got into psychedelics. But the first time that I tried San Pedro Cactus, that's when I realized that I was not okay as I thought I was because it started bringing up memories of my sexual abuse.
Yeah.
And I took several months after that. So I started in the fall of 2018, and it wasn't until the following year that I started experimenting with psilocybin. For someone that didn't allow themselves to feel anything, that was very difficult that I didn't touch mushrooms for several years after that. So my primary tool that I used to start healing myself was through free-based DMT, so dimethyltryptamine, which is one part of ayahuasca. And this is what I use. So the free-based DMT usually takes within 7 to 15 minutes, sometimes 30 minutes, and they consider it like a mini ayahuasca. And
Yeah.
this is how I started healing myself. So it took 3 years to heal my mind. And then in the
And
summer of 20.
you're gonna give us a little like, how does that work? Because we can't skip
Yeah.
over that. You can skip over it now, but come back later.
Yeah, I'll come back to it. I just want to kind of speed up people to where I am at in the journey right now. So it took 3 years for me to heal my mind. And then I went through this phase that I call the transition period. So you have to understand that I didn't realize it back then. I was dealing with antisocial traits. I was actually becoming a little sociopath when I was 11 years old. And so I was left with these traits, right? This is why I teach people about the shadow. I mean, my story is so complicated, right? So I do tell people that I had very disturbing behaviors as a child. So I was left with these antisocial traits. You know, they used to be called sociopathic traits, but now they call them antisocials.
They used to be called what?
Sociopathic traits. Now they
Okay.
call them antisocial.
Antisocial. Got it.
Yeah. So to explain a little bit of some of my behavior as an 11-year-old child, my father was very abusive. As far as age three, I remember him, for example, dunking my mom's head in the toilet, and I would be standing there watching this. So he was a very violent man. When I was 5 years old, he actually attempted to kill us, and I was in the closet hiding with my mother, you know. So he was very violent. He was stalker. I mean, this was back in the early 80s, so late 70s, early 80s, when the laws that we have in place now were not there to protect women at the time. And since my mom was an illegal immigrant during that time period, they wouldn't call the cops for these things out of fear that they would get deported.
Of course.
So my mom had to endure about 8 years of stalking from my father, and he
Did
would
they
just come out of.
split and he still followed her? Or did
Yeah,
she
I
stay with
mean,
him?
my mom left him when I was almost 4 years old, but he kept stalking her afterwards. I mean, he would just beat her on the street whenever we went out. I mean, this kind of abuse. And there was nothing to protect her back then. Nothing. And then I was dealing also with childhood sexual abuse that started at age four and went on till I was about 7 or 8 years old. And this was by multiple male relatives in within the family and outside. So I had a lot of different traumas to deal with. I was also dealing with severe depression that started when I was age 11. I actually came close to slicing my wrist at age 11. I did attempt suicide when I was 21. I survived. I never even made it to the hospital. This is when I realized that I must have a high tolerance for drugs because I took a bunch of pills to try to kill myself and I wasn't successful. So I was dealing with suppression for quite a long time. When I started this journey with psychedelics, I was really at the lowest point. I even had this secret plan that if nothing changed by the time that I was 50, I was just going to end my life. I'm turning actually 50 next month, and I am nowhere close to anything like that. No, none of this. So I went through this transition period where I was trying to kind of re-enter society. I had self-isolated for many years, and I didn't realize this. I had a really hard time connecting with people. If I can describe what I felt like I was some alien that got dropped into this planet. So I didn't have this connection with people, which is also with antisocial traits, is you have this hard time bonding with people. And so when I started coming out of self-isolation in the summer of 2021, this is where I started forming healthy relationships with people, starting to understand my behaviors. And then by the summer of 2023, I started coming to this knowing. It's the only way I can describe it throughout my whole being that the next step that I needed to take was the healing of my body. Back then, I was close to 300 pounds. The biggest that I weighed myself was 275. And so I had been morbidly obese for most of my life. I did have a binge eating disorder. And I need to
I
clarify
can't
because.
imagine why you would, why
I
would
mean,
you come up with.
I didn't understand it why I had this eating disorder. And what I want to clarify, binge eating, it's secret eating. Some people think that binge eating is just eating a lot of food. No, binge eating is you eating in secret and eating a massive amount of food. I mean, I would eat so much, like it was a weekly thing for me that nobody has ever seen me eat like that. Nobody. I was always very careful that nobody was around. I went to great extremes. I was with somebody during that time period when my eating disorder was kind of, when I was kind of going through the healing process and dealing with my eating disorder. And I remember I would wait, like watch the clock, like begging him to leave because my craving for food was so strong. And I would even watch like outside the window to make sure that he left so that he wouldn't return to watch me eat. And so I would eat massive amounts of food in secret to the point where I felt like vomiting. And even that wouldn't stop me. I mean, that's how strong my addiction was. And during the time when I was healing my mind with DMT, it ended up switching it off. And it was not something that I was expecting at all. And when it switched it off, it was so jarring for me because you have to understand, I had been depending on food since I was 3 years old. I was already almost 43 years old. And to have this switch off was very jarring because I no longer had my support with me. This was my support. Food was my support system in order to manage my emotions. And since I didn't have this anymore, I actually tried to reactivate my eating disorder, if you can believe that. But
But
I
you
couldn't
missed
do
it.
it. So I had to find different methods of dealing with my emotions during this transition period, right? And last year in January, I had a gastric sleeve. I wasn't sure what to expect with the healing of my body. The prior year before that, a psychologist that I had befriended during one of my ayahuasca sessions, they messaged me out of the blue during the time when I was realizing that the next step was to heal trauma from my body. And the book was The Body Keeps the Score by Wessel van Kolk.
I just read that.
Yeah.
So
And
good.
so for me, this was confirmation from the universe that yes, this was the next step. So when I started last year, I wasn't sure what was going to happen in the healing process with my body. And in March of last year, I ended up having this atomic bomb of a trigger. I won't go into the details. I will say that a sexual predator crossed my path, and this brought out this rage that I had been holding in onto since I was 11 years old. And I believe now that this was the rage that was turning me into a little sociopath, when I was younger. And so since last year and this year, I've been trying to understand where did this rage come from. Last year, I realized that it brought out my shadow. And this is something that I've been teaching people of getting to know the darker side of our personalities. So it triggered it, brought out my shadow, and along with the shadow, it brought out this tremendous rage that I felt as a child, as an 11-year-old child, realizing that the sexual abuse that happened to me was not okay. So I didn't have an outlet to release this rage that I felt that I was taking it out on others when I was younger. So my target were boys, core men were my target. This is where my rage was coming from towards this particular group. And so last year was dealing with the rage that came from the sexual abuse. And then this year I got triggered and it brought out another layer to my shadow, which I realize now I have a defiance against authority. So this ended up bringing out the rage that I felt towards my father. And what I'm noticing with the healing of my body is very different than healing the mind. What I'm noticing is dealing more with emotional trauma than actual mental stuff. And since I never had this outlet to release this rage, only now am I starting to understand where all this came from. And just like Carl Jung's, I'm very big on Carl Jung's philosophy of understanding the shadow. Because once you start understanding these parts of yourself, it's as if you start having more love for your being. I used to be afraid of this. So I'll explain why I was afraid of my shadow. I tell a lot of my people who are in my group, I'm currently doing a beta test with a group of people with psychedelics, freebase DMT, but in the form of Changa. So Changa is DMT infused with herbs and an MAOI inhibitor like a Harmala, like Syrian Rue or Kapi. So this is what I'm working with this group. But anyways, so when I was 11 years old, I was already starting to display antisocial traits. And I was starting to abuse animals. And I remember this particular summer, some of the boy, there was this neighborhood dog. It was a little terrier dog that was just roaming our neighborhood. And they had lured this dog into my garage. So the boys were hitting on this dog, kicking it. And I was just observing, having no emotion whatsoever. And women always try to prove themselves in front of boys a bit more extreme than normal. So I picked up this dog and I threw it as hard as I could against the wall. And when it hit the wall, it just dropped straight down. And I thought I had killed this animal. Now, mind you, I was 11 years old. And at the time, I was just thinking, oh my God, I need to get rid of this body because my mom is going to get mad at me. And for some reason, when I bent down to pick up the dog, it was as if the switch ended up turning on within me, and I started feeling remorse for what I had done. So this started this belief within myself that I had something evil within me. So I would get plagued as a teenager with sleep paralysis, for example, and I'm starting to understand that this was my shadow trying to make me acknowledge it, but I wouldn't, right? Because I had made this belief that this part of me was evil. But now, as I started since last year and this year looking at my antisocial traits, where did they originate from? I'm starting to look at it, not just this small picture that I thought of it. I now have a bigger picture where this originated from. So, for example, the defiance that I have now against authority, I traced it back obviously to my father. And the anger that I felt with the sexual abuse was also tracing it back to one particular uncle that was the primary abuser of me when I was younger. So this is where I've been on this journey currently, is looking at the darker aspects of our shadow and trying to understand where do these behaviors originate from. And this is where I'm currently on. And what I'm also encouraging other people is to be brutally honest about your darker aspects of our personalities, because there's power and potential if you can get past the negativity. And what I tell people now is that it has a lot of power if you know how to tap into it and turn it into something positive. So the rage that I was feeling last year, for example, I used that as fuel to put myself through the master program, which I am now. So I'm using it for something positive, and also to help people understand why they behave in certain ways. And the only ways that you find out about these behaviors is when you get triggered, right? I know, it's
Wow.
I mean, I've been doing this for 7 years. It's like, how can you explain 7 years of healing, you know?
No. And I mean, I'd heard this story before, so this is a retelling, just like a broadened retelling. I mean, I'm fascinated. We had, I think I told you, we had a man on the War Room 2, 3 months ago named Jerrall Blanchard. And there were he did his presentation. It kind of felt like it was three portions. So the first part, so he's a I want to say psychotherapist. I don't know what kind of therapist. He's some kind of therapist. And he had done some work with people attracted, well, basically just people who were in prison for doing something sexual with children, right? And he talked to these men, you know, hundreds of them. And you know, did therapy with them and had their writings. So the first 30 minutes or so, he was kind of sharing that work and sharing things that the men had written and just things that he had learned from talking to these men. And I thought he did just an amazing job of helping me empathize with men that society doesn't even want to, they don't even want to say it out loud. Like they don't want to look at it, they don't want to talk about it, they want to, you know, cut their balls off or kill them or whatever. He helped me understand what it would feel like to grow up, you know, go through your life knowing that everyone thinks you're just the most evil thing ever. That that's something you something that's inside your head that you can't change, you know, being attracted to a minor. He kind of treated it, I think he's the one who treated it like a or maybe that was later, but my understanding is that people think of it the same way as a gay attraction. It's just an attraction that they have a hard time quelling. And so if you know you have this attraction and you can't quell it, and you know that that means that everyone around you thinks you're terrible, how it must feel to just walk around your whole life feeling terrible. You can't trust a soul. You can't tell a single person what you're feeling. Just like I'm sure you weren't like walking around telling people you threw a dog against the wall, right? You are so afraid of that part of yourself that you think of it as a separate person.
And
And
that's what
so,
I'm doing. And that's exactly what I'm doing. So I've been testing a group now. I've been doing sessions. I have been doing sessions for free for the past 3 years, and I had to stop this year. So I started with a different group where I'm doing a test group where I'm getting them to know their shadow. And by me being open about my shadow, because I tell people, I seriously doubt your shadow is as dark as mine, right? And with regarding with my sexual abuse, I really had to deal with a lot of this rage that came out after I got triggered. And one of the things that I tell people is pay attention to the memories that come up after a trigger, because these are clues that are pointing to you the origins of where this came from.
yeah.
So I kept getting this memories of my uncle, and he was the primary abuser when I was younger. And when I was
And at
13,
that time, did you remember that he was your primary abuser? Like, do you remember that? Did you remember the abuse, or had you stuffed it down?
No, I he was always the one that stuck on me the most because he was the most prolific one of all of them. Like other ones were just a one-time thing that didn't really, and since I was so young and I thought it was normal for this, it didn't really register. But it was when he started abusing me again when I was 13 years old, and he came very close to raping me at that time, and I froze my body. You know how you have the flight, fight, or freeze? Well, I froze when he started molesting me. I couldn't get my body to do anything. And when he came close to raping me, he was on top of me on my back. I would sleep on my stomach so he wouldn't touch me, right? And when he got on my back getting ready to rape me, it was, I don't know, it was like something finally clicked and my mind said, no, we're not going to let this happen. And I got him off me and I ran into the bathroom and I locked myself in. He still continued to molest me afterwards, but then he finally returned to Mexico. So I was getting all these images last year about my uncle. And I finally decided, you know what, I'm gonna look at my uncle's memories, but I stepped back as an observer because I wanted to understand why was my mind keep bringing him up. And when I finally looked at him, really looked at him, I realized my uncle was not that much older than me when he started abusing me and other people. I was not the only one in the family he was abusing, by the way. I found this out years later, and even 4 years ago, I found another cousin came forward. So he would molest males or females, it didn't matter. And so I started thinking, okay, my uncle wasn't that much older than me. He was already doing this stuff. And then I had this epiphany moment. And this is when I started really having compassion for my uncle, which I thought I would never feel towards this man. I realized who abused him, right? Who abused my uncle? Because he was doing things that no child would learn on their own if it wasn't an adult teaching them. And when I made this realization, you know, I had this hatred for this man my whole life. Anytime anybody mentioned him, I would flare up in rage. And that was the moment where I can say that I finally was able to release it, the rage that I felt towards him. And I felt compassion for my uncle. And I guess since I was turning into a sociopath and I have this understanding, you know, one of the questions in psychology is why you can have two people coming from the same type of environment, yet one of them becomes an abuser and the other one doesn't. And the question is why? I can answer that, why I was turning into a sociopath, because of the rage that I had inside. That's what was turning me. This tremendous, I cannot even describe this rage that I felt. And it's funny because I went to an exhibit on serial killers and I was listening to some of the videos that they had at this exhibit. And what a lot of them were mentioning was this rage, right? This rage that they couldn't control and it just went out to, and it just manifested where they started hurting others. You know, they couldn't control it. Me, I was able to stop myself. I knew that if I didn't, this at age 11 was when I started suppressing my shadow. I understand now the only time that it would flare up was if I got triggered in some way, but I didn't understand the mechanisms of this until just recently, you know? And this is where I'm at with my research, understanding the shadows and how you can integrate this as something positive as part, because it's part of you. Even though you try to separate it, it's still part of you. And I grew to love my shadow, even everything that it has done, because I understand where did all this behavior originate? And it originated from the traumas that I had as a
Right.
child.
Oh, imagine that.
Right. And
So
it's
when you were able to have some empathy for what you went, when you found empathy for your cousin or your uncle,
uncle.
you were able to find,
I was able to
some,
release the rage.
right. And then when you found able when you know when you're finally able to recognize that your evil side is just a reaction to something that happened to you, where you're able to forgive yourself.
Yes.
And reconnect with that side.
Yeah, because what I realize now is that since I didn't have any support, emotional support, my mother was 17. She got married at 16. She had me when she was 17. So she was still a child herself. And my maternal grandmother never showed any affection. So my mom was repeating, so it was a generational trauma that was going on with the family. When I started waking up with psychedelics and seeing my behavior, now I didn't recognize that I was repeating the same pattern as my mother, as my grandmother, my mother, and here I was doing the same thing with my children. When I made that realization, it was very hard to admit that I had not been as supportive emotionally to my children as I thought I had been. And this was very hard to admit. You know, I actually apologized to my children. The last 5 years, I've been trying to rebuild the relationship with them. And I opened about them and I told them I was not okay. You know, I had a lot of things to deal with, but I'm healthier now and I'm trying to, you know, be there in a way that I hadn't been with them before. But I had not, if I had not gone through this healing journey, I would have not recognized it. I would have just been repeating the same pattern and passing the baton on to the next generation, you know? So yeah, it's
Wow,
been quite a journey.
that is really powerful. Wowza. Okay, everybody, I think would it'd be probably be okay if people throw in a question at
Yeah,
this point
that's
in the
fine.
okay. So if anybody remember that if you I think you click on react and then one of the options is raise hand. So if anyone would like to ask Cynthia a question, I don't mean to hog the whole conversation, but up oh, and there's a hand right there. Okay, you are unmuted, Jim.
I noticed the chat won't open up either, so I couldn't get in
Oh,
the
okay.
chat.
Hey, Chuck, can we just change the like the base settings for that? It's so annoying. Because every time this happens, we have to ask Chuck to do it, and then we don't remember to do it because it just happens again. Are you there, Chuck? Why is Chuck muted? Maybe he went to the
Well,
bathroom.
anyway, I'll ask my question to
Okay, well he's probably in the bathroom or something. Go on.
When I turned, I also when I turned turned on the Zoom at 8, you were talking a little before 8, so I didn't get the whole story of all the psychedelics she was
Oh no, we
taking.
that I didn't start till the my computer said 7 before we started talking. So but
Okay,
yeah, we could 100% she can
but
re she didn't tell us a whole lot about the psychedelics at the beginning
yeah,
anyway. So you didn't miss
and
anything.
first of all. So, have you heard of the power of forgiveness and inner healing? Have somebody, so there's a lot of teachings on inner healing through forgiveness. Our church does what is inner healing ministry and based on forgiving others and God being in our past as well. And the second question is, now are these psychedelics addictive too? Is this another thing that, because like alcohol or some things cover up the pain of these traumas, so you know you could get something addicted to something else as well, like these psychedelics. I don't know, but I've learned forgiveness is also like you talked about forgiving your uncle, that it's also strength and healing.
Yes, I mean, that's one thing I teach people is the importance of not just forgiving others, but forgiving yourself for any any behaviors that you had in the past. It's understanding that there is an origins to it. To answer your questions with psychedelics, no, they're not addictive. There's a lot of studies that are currently being done to help people actually that are going through addictions. For example, Iboga is one of the psychedelics that are
Is that
currently being,
Ibogaine?
Ibogaine. I call it Iboga, but this is one of the psychedelics that is being used to treat addictions actually. And it's been pretty successful, but there's a lot of risk with this one. Ayahuasca is another psychedelic also. Ayahuasca is a primary of two components. So it's a DMT and an MAOI inhibitor. So it could be like Kapi, for example, on the ayahuasca rue, or sometimes they'll use a Syrian rue as the inhibitor. The types of psychedelics that I started with was I tried San Pedro cactus, which is a tea that I drank. And then I moved on to psilocybin, which are mushrooms. I didn't stay too long on the mushrooms because since I'm not a person that allowed myself to feel, mushrooms was too difficult for me.
You expand
I
on that
think
a minute?
It's also because of my antisocial traits, since I have empathy, but it was a rather low. It got better as I started healing with psychedelics. I started having more compassion and empathy. So then mushrooms, then I went to freebase DMT. So freebase DMT, I extracted this from this bark called Mimosa hostilis. There's a simple process that you can do in order to extract the DMT. And this is a very, they call this the businessman trip because it only lasts a few minutes, but it can feel very long. And this is what I primarily use to heal myself for the next 3 years. And also I did do some ayahuasca in between, but primarily it was freebase DMT is what I used. The last session that I had was on September 12th of this year. It was an ayahuasca session, and I did this after a trigger. So what I'm kind of researching right now is what happens if you do psychedelics after getting triggered. And this is what I've been experimenting with groups. I had already been doing with the freebase DMT. Anytime that I felt depressed, I would use the DMT and then I would feel better afterwards. But I never done a trigger right after a major one. So last year I got triggered. 2 days later, I did psilocybin. It was excruciating, but it was also very beneficial because I ended up releasing a lot of the rage that I was holding on to. This year I got triggered on September 8th. I had a ayahuasca session on September 12th. This was very intense, and this is where I confronted my 11-year-old shadow's rage, like really got into the core of the shadow. And this was and then I had an emotion. So I'm very familiar with my pattern of releasing trauma. So I got triggered on the 8th. I had the session on the 12th. And then I had this period where I was feeling pretty good. I knew that there was just going to be this dip. And this is where I start getting really sad. And I wouldn't describe it the same as depression. The way I would describe it, imagine a sponge that's filled up with water getting ready to squeeze. And when I get to that point, the way that I've been noticing my body releasing the emotional trauma is through tears and through memories and reliving them and letting go of the sadness and the rage that I felt through that. So this is what my process has been like. And then after I release a trauma, I tend to have this fatigue afterwards because it can be very exhausting having to release trauma. Bless you.
Thank you.
So right now I'm kind of getting back up where my mood is starting to feel the energy again. And I don't know what more is coming regarding my shadow. So far, I feel I've gotten rid of a lot of the rage that I had. And I've been noticing so many positive changes in my life, the way I approach life and everything. Very different. I have very loving friendships now. I no longer feel like an alien around people. I can interact. I still like to keep to myself sometimes, but I'm getting better with that. And even the relationship that I have with my children, I see improvements. I'm honest about things with them, the things that happened to me, because it's important that they understand that it wasn't something that I was doing on purpose or anything like that. There was a reason for my behavior, and it
Right, in the
was
same way
healing.
that you needed to recognize that your uncle, there was a reason for
Yeah,
his behavior, right?
exactly.
Because if all you're
Exactly.
seeing is this tiny piece of someone and you don't understand where it came from and you don't have any empathy, yeah, the middle section of remember I told you that guy Gerald Blanchard,
Yeah.
the middle section, the first section was have empathy for people who abuse children. The second section was all about psychedelics. He talked about ibogaine being used, ibogaine for ending addictions, and forgotten which one he said was really. Oh, it might have been. I'll think of it in a second. But it was really good for helping people find empathy.
Was it psilocybin? Because that's where he
Maybe
got up finding.
MDMA, maybe
MDMA. Yeah.
MDMA. And don't quote me on that. But you know, he talked about that he was able to use something, maybe MDMA, to help these men find empathy for. You know, whoever they needed to find empathy for.
Yeah.
And then he had a whole big chunk of it where he was talking about like Native American heal circles and how they use healing circles and what a better job that they did in these Native American communities at like helping these men heal. So because they're Native American, they're like they're not really part of the United States exactly. They have their own like reservation and have get to do their own thing. If someone got in trouble, they could say, no, we're not sending you to prison. We don't think prison is good. We don't want you in prison. We're gonna take care of this ourselves. And so the community as a group would get together and talk through things, and like so everybody knew what was going on, everybody knew what the rules were, and then these men would do things that they needed done, like visiting shut-ins. And he talked specifically about one guy who was visiting shut-ins. He didn't have a car, so he had to walk. And the understanding in the whole community was everybody says hi to him. Every time you pass him, everybody's going to say hi, and he's going to say hi back. And I thought, how different that is than what the way we do it here.
I mean, I have I'm of indigenous descent, so I'm of Purepecha descent, and I still so I what I'm trying to do is I am getting a master's in psychology, and I'm trying but in the scientific side, so as a researcher. And what I'm trying to is infuse some of these traditions, these Mesoamerican tradition, as part of the healing, because for example, in the Mexican culture, when you see a healer, it's done with family and friends. It's not done in a group in front of strangers. It's done as a community with the people that are there to support you. And then they go through the cleansing and things like this. And this is what I try to teach people also, because they have also this thing called pláticas. So pláticas is where you're speaking your truth in front of others, or you're speaking your truth by yourself by talking to the creator or the universe, whatever you want to call it. So I teach people to talk as if you're talking to somebody, because it's important that you release the truth, whatever it is that you're holding on to. Because if you don't, I'm a firm believer that it starts manifesting in some way in your body or in the behavior. Or you get sick in some physical way. I believe this. So I encourage people to be honest. And by me being brutally honest about my shadow, I'm encouraging others to, hey, it's okay, talk about yours. It's about having compassion, not just for yourself, but also for other people that hurt you. It has taken me quite a journey to get to this point, but I feel compassion for everybody. I released a lot of the anger that I felt, particularly to my father. I had a reunion with him last year. I still don't know if I want to have him in my life, but I'm getting more open to the idea now, because I also understand that he had a very abusive childhood, very traumatic, and I can understand where the rage that he felt towards women came from. I understand it, talking to other family members and trying to understand why did he become an abuser towards women. And in understanding his traumas, I realized, okay, I was already predisposed to these genes and then environment. So I was already on this path. This was my path, but I stopped myself at age 11 when I became scared of my shadow. So I understand this is something that's also genetic. I'm
Well,
predisposed already.
God, the thing I just love about all of this is what our families have been doing for generations, right? Abusing, not healing, abusing, not healing, abusing, not healing. And so the idea that you're able to like explain that, understand it, heal it, like this is exactly how I felt the whole time Jerrall Blanchard was talking. I was like, I wish I could just put everything you're saying on a speaker and like play it in the grocery store, because what a freaking difference this would make to the universe.
Yeah,
You do
because
have a hand up.
you start having more compassion for the abuser as well, because you start understanding, okay, I understand. Not that it's making an excuse or anything like that, but a lot of the reason, what I'm starting to understand is a lot of the reason that these abusers are turning up these people who are already predisposed to these environments, or whether it's genes or whatever, is that rage that they're not able to manage, whether it's rage towards a parent or a family or somebody. It's not being able to release that
Right. We're
rage.
stuffing everything down. We're training people to stuff stuff down. And that's another great thing I heard. This was on a Restorative Action Alliance thing. Her name was it'll come to me later. But she talked about that a lot of times if you were abused as a child, as you As you try to manage that abuse, your brain learns to just kind of stuff it down, stuff it down, stuff it down. And later, when you are an adult and people in your space are like, you're starting to see the shadows of something that reminds you of your abuse, you don't call it out. You don't say, hey, don't do that. Your brain says, that's scary. Stuff it down, stuff it down.
Exactly.
So you're not being a good bystander. So even if you don't grow up to be an abuser yourself, if your brain has not figured out how to heal from that, and it's still stuffed in there, your brain just stuffs everything you see down. So you're not a good supporter of other people.
I had seen this clip recently. I don't know how far back it took place, but it was about the 17-year-old girl that set fire to a Walmart. I don't know where this took place. And as they were arresting her, she said something that really struck me. She said, "I don't know what I did, why I did that. I don't understand." And I'm like, "That's shadow." Well, that's shadow. By her not understanding her shadow, she ended up doing something terrible that even herself was shocked that she did something like that, you know? And
Okay,
this is where I tell. Go
we have a
ahead.
hand up just for the record, so because otherwise we just keep talking. I know
Yeah,
everybody's waiting. Finish your sentence, and then we'll call on the guy. And Chuck, have you opened the chat so people can chat with each other? I hope Chuck didn't like fall over or fall into the well. Okay, I'm gonna just everyone, if you want to just post it to me, and I'll post your comments in the chat because I don't know where Chuck is or what's going on. Okay, I'm gonna call on Abasi. Unmute.
How you doing? She answered my question pretty much, but she's in having to talk. But I have one question for you, and you may not be able to answer it right now at this moment.
Okay.
I would like the name of the therapist that was working in the Colorado facility, and they fired her because she was being too sympathetic toward the patients. And I wrote it down, but I couldn't get it. I know she's on Twitter or something like that, but you remember that episode I'm talking about, right? I don't expect you to remember that right now.
I know who you're talking about. It wasn't Colorado, it was Kansas.
No, it was a black girl. I think it was Colorado.
Was her name Thaisa Carvalho Mick?
I don't remember her name. It
It
was a
was she on
black
the
girl.
war room? She on the war
Yeah.
room. Yeah, it was
And I.
Thaisa Carvalho Mick. She's from Larned, Kansas. And
Okay,
she worked at a facility for 5 months. As soon as she started meeting the guys were like, oh, they're not gonna like you. Start taking notes. And sure enough, 5 months later, she got fired. Basically, they claimed it was because like it was during COVID, and they told her they didn't have a mask small enough to fit her mouth. So she went to a hospital, got a fancier mask that fit her mouth. She came to work, and they were mad at her for showing up at work and violating their rules, and they eventually just fired her. And now she's made lots of videos on the internet about it, and she's gone to talk to the Kansas lawmakers about it. Yeah, she's something else.
So before I let somebody, what was her name again? I'm trying to write it
Perfect.
down.
I'm going to put it in the chat, Thaisa Carvalho Mick, and I'll go find one of her YouTube videos.
Because
She's
I
had a
was
couple. Go on.
okay. Thank you. That's what I wanted. Thank you. Because the lady, she answered my other question. Because I was actually going to ask her about, would she ever think she can get like restorative justice? Would she ever think she could talk to her father again and stuff like that? But she pretty much answered that.
Nice. Okay, so I've got a post here in the I'm about to put in the chat. This is just one of the videos she's made. She made this particular video with a guy named Joshua Berglund, who I think I might have had on this call. I think I might have done a war room with him once. But she's made ones with just her talking and basically explaining all the ways that what they're offering in these civil commitment facilities is not therapy. There's nothing good about it, and they're basically making it impossible for these guys to get out.
Yeah. I mean, that's one thing about, I mean, I haven't lived in the US for quite a few years, and I compared to Germany, they're more sympathetic about rehabilitating people. They use a more humane system when incarcerating people. Because the US has this mentality of, it's from the older generations, like tough on crime kind of mentality. And
Well, that was from the
even
90s, from the
after
early
somebody,
90s.
yeah, and even after somebody does their time, they're still getting punished. For example, they have a felony they have a very hard time finding a job there. You're pretty much forcing these people to resort to like what they were doing in the past. And of course, they're going back into jail like this revolving door because you're making it harder as it is. You want to keep punishing them for the rest of their lives. And this is not something that is acceptable in this society anymore.
Well, in Germany, I met Stephen Witset from Germany. He does this thing called common sense law. He's on the internet a lot, and he says in Germany, I think he said it was illegal to hold something against him if it's more than 10 years old. That people are not. It's not just like, well, you can forgive him after. I'm going to forgive him after 10 years. You forgive him when you want. No, like everyone is required to forgive you after 10 years and let you go back to your life. And what a difference that would make. That's the difference between the way we treat people on the register, people forced to register here, and the way the Native American community, everybody was forced to, everyone was not forced. It was just, it was, that's the culture. We're all gonna say hi to, Bert every time we pass him on the road. And what a difference that would make to feel like everybody knows your struggle and is supporting you, as opposed to everybody hates me and they're going to hate my kids and my wife and my mom and everyone who's nice to me is going to be treated badly. Like I had an experience in May. I went to my niece's graduation and I'd known, so this is my sister-in-law and all of her siblings and all of their partners and all of their children. Well, actually the kids were nice, but all these women and men who had known me for 30 years just acted like I wasn't even there. Not because of something I did, but because I have a partner who 18 years ago clicked on a wrong box. They felt it was legitimate and I'm sure they thought they were righteous, just kind of dismissing me because I had the nerve to love someone and forgive someone. What have like it just blew my mind. I cried about it for days. I wrote her an 8-page letter and I sent it to all of her brothers and sisters. Said like, you think you're in the right here? I'm pretty sure you're being complete assholes and you should really think about it. 'Cause like, what? How is this helpful? I just don't know how we do that. Got a question, Abasi, or a comment? Anybody have a comment? So DMT, tell me a little bit more about it. It's about a 50. I've watched a friend of mine do DMT months, and I think it's pretty fast, right? How long does it
Yeah, it's pretty
last?
fast. It can last anywhere between 7 to 30 minutes. Usually between 7 to 15 minutes is the average. And so basically when I have the session with people is they need to have an intention first, like what they want to work on. Because one thing I tell people is that when you're under psychedelics, it'll sometimes show shine the light on your shadow, which some people consider bad trips. I don't think there's such thing as bad trips. I consider it as a bad misinterpretation of your shadow. Because if you're afraid of your shadow, you're gonna think this thing is evil when it's being shown to you. So with DMT, I use it now in, like I said, in a Changa form. So Changa was created by this guy in Australia named Julian Palmer in the early 2000s. And he got the name actually from an ayahuasca session that he did. So he was shown how to, the name was given, if I understood correctly. So basically, what it is a mixture of herbs that's infused with free-based DMT and an MAOI inhibitor. So, like a kapi or Syrian rue. And this is, makes the duration
So,
longer than free-based.
what is an tell me what is an MA? What are we inhibiting? What's MAOI mean?
So, an MAOI is a base, is a monooxide.
You don't need to know what it stands for, but it's some kind of chemical.
Basically, when you take DMT, when you smoke it, you, for example, if you try to take oral DMT, it won't do anything at all because your body, your gut is already attacking it. It won't let it absorb. So you need an MAOI inhibitor. So it's like a Harmala, which can be Syrian rue or kapi. And this dismantles the gut and permits the DMT to penetrate, and then it
Got
takes
it.
effect.
Okay. Got it. So basically
So without this, you
it's
can't, I mean,
inhibiting
you can
something in
smoke.
your own body.
Well, I mean, you can smoke it. You can smoke free-based DMT without any MAOI inhibitor, and this can, but it only lasts a few minutes. But if you wanted to last a little bit longer, then you would add the MAOI inhibitor, so the Harmala to it. in order to extend the trip a little bit longer. So it's like a mini ayahuasca, just for
Got
duration.
it. So you're doing something that lets it stay in your system a little bit longer so you
Yeah,
can
correct.
get more out of the trip.
Correct.
Okay, got it.
Correct. But if you take it in, for example, in the brew, like the ayahuasca brew, that can last a few hours. But smoking it just between 7 to 15 minutes or 30 minutes, and then you're back to normal as if nothing happened.
Right.
And going into the DMT realms is not the same like LSD or psilocybin. It is, they call it the spirit molecule for a reason, and this was by Rick
The what
Strassman.
molecule?
The spirit molecule. This is a
Spirit
term that was
molecule. Okay.
coined by Rick Strassman. And it's very hard to put it into words what the experience is like. DMT is like a near-death experience. We all have DMT in our bodies. It's in different plants and animals. Scientists believe this is what causes a near-death experience when somebody is dying. So I tell people sometimes, like, yeah, you're going to be having a near-death experience when you smoke DMT. And it makes you wonder if there's something out there besides, if there's something, I guess spirit is what you call it,
Yeah.
because it makes you really question a lot of things in life.
I have a friend who did DMT once, and I mean, he's done DMT a bunch of times, but I've only watched him do it once. And I remember he kind of fell off the couch he was sitting on for a second, just fell a little bit to the floor. And I went over and touched him, and he said, "At the point where you touched me, I had forgot I existed. And the only thing that reminded me that I still existed was when you touched my arm." Because he was like in the universe doing like universe stuff. So can you kind of, like, you say you have to have an intention. Does having that intention before you smoke it or whatever, does that help guide your experience a little bit? Like, what if you had no intention?
I mean, it's okay if you don't have, like, you could say, for example, I let the spirits decide what they want to show me, for example. That's still an intention. It's important to at least have an idea where you think you need to start, and then they show you where exactly you need to begin. But what I've noticed, especially, I'm very big on getting to know the shadow. So when I tell people, if spirit is showing you something, because what I notice in with the group is, let's say you're going through the DMT experience and it's showing something that you perceive to be negative and you kind of avoid it, right? You don't want to look at it. And then you do another trip and it's showing the same thing. And you're like, and I tell people, if you cannot even look at what they're showing you, you're not going to be able to advance further in your healing until you deal with what they're reflecting.
Yeah, and I've heard that same thing, and I remember he said something like that in The Body Keeps the Score too. His guidance was lean in. If you see something that's like, I don't know about that, lean in, pursue it and see what's going on.
Yeah. I mean, a perfect example. So I found out just a couple of months back that I have this defiance against authority. And the only reason I found out I had this is because I got triggered, right? And it had to do something. I had to go to court. I have my youngest child is autistic. So I went to what they call, it's not really like Child Protective Services, but it's an organization here where it's about families and children. And I went there to ask if somebody can take my son out once a week because of school and work. I didn't have much time to take him out. So I requested somebody to take him out. Well, the person wanted to get a lot more involved than what I requested. And I said, that's not necessary. I cannot be going on appointments because I need the time to study and do my assignments. And plus, I have two adult children. I have my ex-husband that lives close by. I don't need to have this unnecessary time. Well, she threatened to take me to court, and this is where my defiance flare out, right? So I came out and I became the observer. So I'm like, okay, I want to see what this behavior does, right? I went to court. I was being very disruptive, and the judge didn't want to deal with me. The lady that brought me to court was in the wrong. So I ended up getting the help that I requested and nothing more. So she pretty much took me to court for no reason. But it was good because it brought up that I have this defiance. And as I started looking back when it started popping up in life, I managed to trace it back to when I was about 7 or 8 years old when this has started coming out, this defiance against authority. And by doing this and understanding it and tracing the origins, I'm like, okay, I was able to trace it, of course, to my father. This is where I got this defiance. And in understanding this, I'm like, okay, I have this trait. What can I do with it? And if I'm becoming some kind of activist in the future, I can use this as power to help me face, because when I'm in behind this part of my shadow, I can be in front of people. I'm not afraid of anything. I'm not afraid if people are against me, because this part of me has no feelings, no emotions, you know. I can use this as something positive. So this is the process that I'm going through, is like, okay, once something pops up in my shadow, how can I use it in a positive manner in order to guide me and help me achieve the things that I want to achieve in my life? And this is how I've been
I
using
love
my
that.
shadow. And I actually, Anne, I've been having a lot of fun getting, you know, I used to be so afraid of this part of me. I thought it was evil, but as I got to understand it and have compassion and love for it, I'm having a lot of fun. The potential that it has and the power that it possesses, and like, oh, goody, it's like finding different talents that I didn't realize I had. And now it's like, what can I do with this now? I know I have this. Well, how can I use it as something positive? And this is how I've been working with my shadow at the moment, and what I've been trying to teach people as well, to not be afraid of your shadow. Get to know it. It has potential. It has power if you know how to use it in a positive way, of course.
I'm loving every minute of this. Okay, so talk to me about, you had some sort of thing coming up in Mexico, in what,
Well,
tell me about what you were doing with Mexico.
I'm currently organizing a retreat in Mexico for a week. I'm planning it in Escondido, Mexico. So it's near the beach. It's in a small town. I do not work in the same manner as other healers. I don't like to use the word shaman. I'm more of the old-fashioned kind. I prefer La Curandera. So people know me as La Curandera Morgana Sin. So curandera just means healer in Spanish. And so, what I teach people is getting to know the shadow. I do speak openly about the behaviors that I displayed as a child. Because by me sharing my shadow, I hope to encourage others to be more open about themselves and to be more loving and compassionate, because a lot of people don't like themselves. You know, they think very negatively of themselves, or they think they're not worthy of love for whatever reason. Whatever negative beliefs they have imprinted themselves or others have done, you know? So I teach people of getting to know their shadow, understanding the trauma, not just a little picture, but a fuller picture. And in understanding that, you know, I'm hoping to bring love and compassion for themselves.
How do you find the people who join your group? Like, where do you find
I
them?
have a little underground following. I have a little underground following here in Berlin. So this is where I have my group. I am starting to come out. I'm actually trying to do more YouTube videos and share a little bit more of the knowledge that I gain and understanding my shadow. Maybe it can help somebody else be more compassionate with themselves. But I'm still kind of trying to get over some of the insecurities of being in front of the camera. So this is where I'm kind of using the
You have
shadow to kind of
insecurities
help
about
me
being in
with
front of the camera?
my. Well, because I'm using my shadow, and that's why. When all
Because
of you in my shadow is like, oh, I don't want to be in front of the
I
camera,
don't
but
see any fear at all. You seem like you're a natural, just for
because
the
I'm
record.
using the shadow. This is where I'm integrating the shadow. Because one of the questions I get from people is, okay, I go through the healing process, I use psychedelics, but how do I integrate this as part of my life? And I show them by example, like right now, this is me using my shadow, my defiance. Because, like I said, this part is not afraid to talk, it can say what it wants without any kind of consequences. So, this is how I'm using it at the moment. Be more comfortable talking in front of the camera, in front of others. So this is me integrating with my shadow at the
So when you go to, I forget where you're going, Mexico?
Yeah, Escondido, Mexico.
Are you
I
planning
still
to
have
find
I'm
like a little posse of people to do some healing with there?
Yeah, I'm going to be organizing a small group because of my master's program at the moment. I won't be able to do it this year. I'm actually finished with my master program in May of next year, so I don't have too much left in my. So I'm thinking somewhere around May or June, I would like to host a session in Escondido. And it's going to involve a lot of techniques of getting to know the shadow. So it's going to be integrating mind, body, and spirit. So the Mesoamericans believe that in order to have full healing, you need to have these three basic ingredients in order to make it a successful healing. Because one thing I noticed with the Western way of thinking, it's just about the mind. But as I'm going through the journey, I realize that no, it's not just about taking care of the mind. It also involves taking care of the body and feeling a connection to some kind of source, whatever you want to call it, whether it's God, spirit, but you need to feel that you are connected to something beyond yourself.
Yeah.
Right. And this is what I'm trying to infuse as part of a new kind of therapy that I'm trying to bring.
Have you read, I read two books kind of at the same time. I was reading one as a book and one is like a read it to me through my ears. And so sometimes I forget which book was which. I know you said you've read The Body Keeps the Score. Have you read How to Change Your Mind by Michael Pollan?
Yes. Somebody actually gave me that book. Yes.
That's another hell of a good book.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
You know, there's a lot of things that, you know, 20 years ago, me would have thought was nonsense.
Yeah,
but like
exactly.
This age me really believes a lot of things that younger me didn't believe. And those two books have been really big eye openers for me, just about the body and about psychedelics and how all these things kind of work together. I cannot wait to introduce you to Gerald Blanchard, because I think you and Gerald Blanchard would have a lot to talk about.
I mean, one thing I'm noticing with the healing of my body is my surgery already, it's going to be 2 years in January that I had the surgery. And usually people that take the surgery that have a battery active surgery tend to fail within the first 2 to 5 years. I've been successful with this surgery because I dealt already with the psychological problems that caused the eating disorder in the first place. And quite honestly, now it's very hard for me. I have to force myself to eat, to be honest, because the satisfaction that food used to give me, it doesn't give me that joy anymore. So right now my struggle is eating a little bit more, but I feel good. I feel very healthy. I feel as if I have liberated a lot of the rage that I was holding on to. And of course, psychedelics played a role in also helping me release this with the session. They were intense, though. I mean, after a trigger, I have to see which people are good candidates for this type of therapy, because after a trigger, it can be very intense, the experience. And it's good to have support there to guide you.
Yes. Okay. So I noticed a question somebody posted in the chat earlier, and I forgot to read it out loud. I'm sure rape is traumatic in the physical sphere, and actually most all the people on the sex registry were raped, as in deceived by words of enticement in all this registry ordeal, then persuaded to come down and meet up with this fictitious person. So the registry is a form of rape in an abusive way. Okay. Jim is asking, where do you get psychedelics? Are psychedelics legal in Germany?
No.
Okay. Yeah, they're not legal here either.
No. No.
I know that there's a group in my city. They're called, I'm losing the name, but there are people who are, you know, there's a club just like the Psychedelic Society. I think it's called the Psychedelic Society. And they meet, you know, they have Zoom meetings. They've got one coming up about ketamine that I'm going to go to. I actually met a guy. He is a neurosurgeon. He's a neurosurgeon, and he just took a new job. He's moving to Atlanta, Georgia, to study ketamine therapy with the leading ketamine therapy person studying that. And they're like, somebody's giving him money to study it. Oh, and Duck just says, I'm in Michigan, and I'm prescribed low-dose ketamine. It works. So, you know, for me, the idea that like for all these years we've been taught to think that drugs are bad, drugs are bad, drugs are bad, drugs are bad, but yet your doctor can still produce your doctor can still write you a script for, you know, fentanyl, but you can't get things like ketamine, you know, MDMA, ayahuasca, things that are like well understood. And that whole book, The Body Keeps, or no, the whole book, How to Change Your Mind. Have you read it yet? I know you said
Yeah, I've
something.
read the book. I read it a year ago, over
It
a year
talked
ago.
about how, you know, in the 60s and maybe early 70s, they were doing really, really big research with psychedelics. And then Timothy Leary, you know, kind of went too far with it and started just like getting people worried about it. And then they just shut it all down.
It was in the late 70s when they really started clamping down on a lot of the research. When I started, because a lot of the assignments I have to go into research, and sometimes I look into psychedelic research, and only I would say the last 5 years is when it started picking up again, because they started, the law started relaxing a little bit on the studies. Where I get, for example, my DMT, I extract it myself. So I extract this for the group.
Oh, you
I know
just
how.
do it yourself. Yeah,
Yeah,
and that's the thing I find the
I used to.
most surprising is like most of the things that you hear about, like LSD, you know, ayahuasca, you know, somehow in your brain you're like trained to think that they're like bad, bad, bad drugs, you know, some bad person making the bad drugs. No, like one of them comes out of a toad. One of them comes out of, you know, like one of them comes out of a plant. They grow, like they're here. We just don't know how to, we don't know how to, we've lost track of it, right? We've forgotten that they exist. The fact that they are here for me means whoever made the universe wants us to have them. You know, mushrooms grow out of the ground. You know, we've been trained to think they're evil, but that they're natural. They grow here. You're making them yourself.
Well,
That's
I extracted myself. So it's not an, I used to actually teach people how to extract DMT from the bark, because I create my own changa. So I have my own process that's very different. I actually have my own little psychedelic brand. I mean,
Wow.
it's still too early. It's still in the pioneering stages in the psychedelic to for products still. But I have been creating different things. I have different recipes. I even have an ayahuasca that lasts only an hour. So I have been experimenting with a lot of things, and I have different recipes that I've been working on for the past few years. So,
Wow, see
I
you where
mean,
they are and they're
I'm ready
at.
when the scene is ready for recreational stuff, then I'm ready to. But for now, I'm just creating things. Just
Yeah,
creating.
that's absolutely fascinating. Just absolutely fascinating. In answer to that other question, someone, where do you get it? So I live in St. Louis, Missouri, and I know I'm like there are people around me. If I search for ketamine therapy in St. Louis, there are people who are offering this. You know, there are people who will mail it to you, and there are therapists you can go talk to when you're on a trip. So I suspect that if you just start looking around, this kind of thing exists.
I mean, especially in Berlin. Berlin is a very big drug city. You know, they party a lot on this, so it's not like ketamine. That's not an e it's easy to get here in Berlin. You just have to know who to ask, but you can always find somebody. There's not anything like that. The same with mushrooms. Some people grow them. I know some people that can grow them. So
Yeah, I do too.
LSD as well. Some people have contacts with LSD. But I usually make my own that I end up getting all this material from Amsterdam. So it gets shipped to me, and it's just the plant material, and then I have to extract it or make the brew or anything like that.
Yeah, that's so cool. Wow. So no questions, really. Nobody. All right. Well, I think this is just, I think this is the future, right? I think you've got a drug, a psychedelic drug that can cure people of alcoholism. Alcohol is a very, it's a very difficult, it's not good for the world, right? People are, we have all kinds of people in all kinds of crisis because of alcohol. You've got a drug that can help people find empathy. Like, we
I
need
mean, that's
empathy.
one thing I would say with psilocybin is that When I first used it, when I was starting in the early stages of my healing, it was too difficult for me to deal with it because it forces you to feel. And since I was somebody that didn't want to feel anything, anytime I felt any kind of emotion, I would suppress it. You know, maybe I would let a few tears and then I would just brush them off and then go on with my day because I used to see showing vulnerability as a sign of weakness. Because of the environment. So I grew up in Southern California where it was gang infested, drive-by shooting. So you couldn't show this type of vulnerability because then you would become a target, right? You would get picked on if you showed any kind of emotion. So because of environment and because of my upbringing, I suppressed a lot of me emotions. And psilocybin was a very difficult drug for me to deal with. Now, I would say the last 3, 4 years, I've been able to use them. I've been able to deal with the emotions that it brings. And yes, it does bring a lot of empathy compared to how I was 4 years ago to compare now, I have way more empathy, way more compassion towards people than I did before. I do teach people about having boundaries, and by having boundaries is keeping the old types of people that used to gravitate towards me, right? Because everybody is like a reflection of yourself. So all these people were a reflection of my shadow, is what I notice now. And now I'm building very beautiful chains of love with people, like beautiful friendships and healthy ones. And I'm going out more with people. And I was not like this 4 years ago, completely different, like night and day.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, the world would be a much better place if we could help people have empathy. And you know, the other thing that the Jerrold Blanchard conversation kind of enlightened me about was he said a lot of these people that he talked to in prison, when he goes back through their like what made them who they are journey, many of them had been abused themselves, of course, duh. And sometimes if they had been abused, you know, like at a certain time, like 11, 12, 13, those 11, 12, and 13-year-olds, that's who they knew how to talk to. They got kind of stunted there. They get sort of their growth stops at the age where they were having this terrible abuse. And so he says sometimes, you know, what we call like, oh, you're a pedophile is we stunted this person when they were 13, and now they want to talk to like 13-year-olds are their jam because they got stopped there. And I think being able to, you know, if that's truly what is happening, and it's very believable that it is, right? I suffered some abuse as a child, and I 100% stuffed that down. I did not think about it or look at it. I forgot all about it from the age of about 11 to 17, and it came back when I was 17 only because I found myself in the house where it had happened, and I was like, it's like opening up a floodgate, and all of a
You got
sudden,
triggered.
I remembered all this thing that had happened to me that I had not thought about for 6 years. And I have also, I have done a couple of psychedelic things, and I've certainly had experiences when I'm on something where I like, it's almost like, I think of it as like returning to a room in my brain. You know, maybe you call it a memory. I think of it as like, you know, entering a space where I'm like, I remember how I felt that day and how things looked that day, and you know, how things smelled that day. And I've had a couple of instances where I kind of go into the room and I like look around and I'm able to see it from a different perspective. You know, I'm able to like understand it in a slightly different way, where, you know, I've thought about it as like saying, huh, I don't think I need to feel yucky about this anymore. You know, if I'm able to think about it differently, like understand the perspectives of the other people in this, in the memory or whatever, and I say to myself, this, you know, it's almost like it has been a room that I have closed off, but I left the light on, right? Something yucky is dripping into that room and I'm just not thinking about it. But when I go into that space and I'm able to think about it in a whole different way and say, huh, you know what? I don't know that I need this space to feel yucky anymore. I don't need that. I think I can turn this light off. Let this forgive myself or forget whoever it needs to be forgiven, forgive them for whatever this is, and sort of just whatever yucky chemical is dripping into that room, turn it, shut it off. And the way I think about it in my head is like literally leaving a light on in a room, shutting the light off, and then just letting that room just get repopulated with different stuff, so it doesn't have to be holding that yucky feeling that you remember. It can be like renovated and filled up with better stuff.
I agree with that concept, because last year, as I started looking into my sexual abuse and releasing some of the rage, so I had to manage my emotions, right? I had to find, besides food, I couldn't turn to food anymore for emotions. So I started thinking, well, what tools can I use? Since sex to me, intimacy was a yucky thing for me. For me, it was like, just get it over with, be done with. There was no love. There was no beauty into it. And now I'm trying to flip that narrative, right? I'm trying to get a different perspective. And what I'm doing is I took up pole dancing. So all the like twerking, I went to a booty therapy that's run by an African woman who does twerking. She was also a victim of sexual abuse and rape. And she uses twerking as a form of therapy to release emotions. So one way that I'm getting out of my comfort zone is by you going to doing these types of dances, or what people consider to be dirty, right? Because it's getting me out of my comfort zone. It's making me, forcing me to look at this, at my body also in a different perspective, in a positive light. And I'm having a lot of fun, actually. It's switching that narrative that I had thought about sex. And I'm still kind of threading into the dating scene a little bit, but I'm learning, setting boundaries, of course, because I don't want to make the same mistakes that I had as an obese woman, right? Because then, as an obese woman, men would treat me like I was nothing, like I was just an afterthought. You know, there would be some people that wouldn't even want to be seen with me in public. And I was accepting of that because that's how low self-esteem that I had about myself.
Yeah.
So as I was, my body was changing, I also had to change my mind of an obese woman into a thinner one. And that also was a journey on its own, because my mind would sometimes make me believe that I was still almost 300 pounds. And I'll be like, no, I'm not, I'm this now. So it's been a struggle also getting used to looking like this now, getting to know who is this person. And as I'm getting to know myself, understanding my body, I'm happier with my life, I notice. I'm really happy right now in the direction with my life is. I no longer are carrying the burdens of my traumas. And this is what I'm trying to help also people is, it's okay to let them go and rewrite the script, how you said, changing that yucky room into something
positive. I don't have to think of this as a shame and yucky and bad. I can say, oh yeah, 11-year-old me felt this way in this space, but I'm not 11, and I can think differently in this space, and I can feel okay about it, and I can understand. Same thing. So you said your uncle, who was the primary abuser, how much older than you was he?
He was about 5 or 6 years older than me.
Yeah,
so
my abuser was 3 years older than me, and eventually I just started thinking, he was just a kid growing into an adult, just like I was a kid growing into an adult. He was just, he was doing it wrong, basically. if you start to think about how that would feel, if you start having empathy for the person that you thought was harming you, I mean, I'm not saying that it's a good, like, yes, we need to do better on all fronts. But what we've been doing isn't changing anything.
Yeah,
the way we've been treating interfamilial sexual abuse has not fixed anything. So we are definitely doing it wrong.
I mean, I still don't know in which area. I mean, there's so many ways that I can go into research. And one thing that I'm really interested in is understanding, why does one become an abuser and why does not, right?
Yeah.
I have a theory that it has to do with the rage that you couldn't, let it out in some positive way. And I'm at the point where I'm willing to understand what are the behaviors that they have, and maybe set up some kind of program to help children not become these abusers and catch them earlier on.
Yeah.
While
Well,
they're
and I
experiencing
cannot wait to get you in touch with Danelle because this is exactly what we're talking about over here. This is exactly what we're talking about. I had the I had a quick idea. It becomes abusers. Oh, so I read a book once called "Harmful to Minors" by Judith Levine, and she worked at Bryn Mawr College. She, well, not Judith Levine, but somebody else that she mentions in her book, worked at Bryn Mawr College, and they did a study where they asked all their undergraduate women to write every sexual thing that had ever happened in the history of their lives. And they got this very big survey of like all the things that had ever happened to all the people. And they ranged from, you know, I used to play prostitute with my girlfriends. I was raped by my dad when I was 7. I had consensual sex with a 20-year-old when I was, you know, it was a wide range of things that had happened to these women. And they also asked the women, how did you react to this? Like, did you, were you suicidal? Did you cut yourself? Did you have to go to therapy? You know, it was a big survey. And the thing that they found the most connected between was there, you know, did bad things happen because of this? Did you cut, suicidal, whatever? The thing that was the most connected wasn't, was it consensual? Nope. Was it forceful? Nope. Was it across an age line? Nope. The thing that made the most connection between damage was, how did the adults in your space react?
Yeah,
Were the
that's
people
true.
around you like, oh, yeah, you were playing doctor, it happens, and just like forgive you and move on? Or was it like, oh my God, that was so terrible, you need to feel bad, God's not gonna love you anymore? Like, whatever negative emotion your adult in your house gave to you about it, that's what stuck with kids.
Yeah, no, I mean, as a child, I was exhibiting some, like sexual, like behaviors because of the sexual abuse. And one of the ways that I got punished for displaying this, now nobody knew I was getting abused at the time, but if I displayed any kind of, for example, I was 7 years old, I was 6 or 7 years old, and for some reason, there was this big box in the room. And I had gotten naked and I had cut a hole out and I was dancing just like a child. I was there with my 4-year-old cousin and we were just playing like kids. Well, my grandmother saw that and she started telling me all kinds of things in Spanish. You're dirty. Like, look how you're behaving. And I don't know if my grandma was the one that gave me this belt beating or if it was my mom after she came home. But I, till this day, so I'm almost 50 years old, and till this day, I can remember getting that beating that stuck with me and this impression of sex or any kind of this type of behavior
Yep, as
imprinted
bad.
this negative thing on me, right? So now I'm trying to deprogram everything that I was taught into
Yep.
something positive.
Yep. That is so, that just, it connects so closely to my own experience and to just what I've heard and what I've heard therapists say about people who experience sexual trauma. And just, yeah, I think this is exactly how it works.
Yeah.
Okay, it's 3:30 in the morning for you. And I know that that is late. I am so excited about our talk. I'm so excited to connect, to share this with Danelle so that she can watch it. And I'm so excited that we connected, and I cannot wait to introduce you to the other people who are going to adore you and think you're amazing. I love the work that you're doing. I'm so excited about all of it.
Thank you for having me on your program, Anne. I really enjoyed it. I thought I was going to be a lot more nervous, but with the shadow, I made it
Well,
through.
you did great. And honestly, the fact that you are courageous enough to stand up and tell this story is so impactful. I mean,
Yeah.
if more people were willing to be honest and share their stories, I think the world
We
would be a
wouldn't
better
have as
place.
much of this violence going on. If people would be more accepting and understanding of that, why that part formed and to
Yeah.
begin with. I look at it as an armor that you build as a child, right?
Yep,
You don't have any
absolutely.
guidance, you build whatever you can at hand and you build this
Right.
armor. It might be fucked up, but you built something, right?
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and people who get damaged as young people and don't have a way to like ever repair that or talk about it. You know, you have anything happen and your grandma's in there making you feel bad. Well, that's not helpful. That's
No.
not healing anything. That's just
No.
hurting us and making it harder for us to heal. And that's just making more trauma in the future. So,
Yeah,
all right.
exactly.
I love you. I was very
All right,
excited to
love
have
you
you.
too.
Thank
Thank
you,
you so
everybody, for
much.
sticking with us. And yeah, wow. Good job.
Thank you. Have
Oh,
a
hang
good
on. Let me
day.
tell people how to save the chat if they need to, although there's not as much in the chat as we sometimes get. But if you want to save the chat, you go into the chat, you click on the three dots, and you click save chat. Oh, and yeah, Chuck, that is where I changed that. So I'll remember to do that next time. All right.
Perfect.
Thanks, everybody. Love
All
you.
right.
This is
Bye.
late.
You're welcome.